Hello and welcome to ADHD Mums. In this podcast, we tackle the tough, often unspoken realities of motherhood, neurodiversity, and mental health. Hello and welcome to season 3 of ADHD Mums. Today we have Marie Cammon back. If you haven't heard her first episode, I'm going to put it in the show notes. It was really interesting. We talked about the social dynamics of being a high school neurodivergent female, and we talked a lot about bullying and our similar experiences, and we touched on ARFID and eating disorders a little bit as well. If you'd like to go back and listen to that, you can. If you don't know who Marie is a clinical psychologist. She's a researcher. She's a proud autistic woman who centers her work around neurodiversity, affirming support for autistic and ADHDers. Marie works mainly in assessment, identity, and well-being. So welcome to you, Marie.
I am super excited to be back. I loved our chat last time.
Okay, so what we are doing today is lived experience with eating disorders, ARFID, and that neurodivergent identity space. Did you want to expand a little bit about your clinical practice and your lived experience and where you're going to come from this episode?
Yeah. So obviously as a clinical psychologist, there's who works with autistic ADHDers and neurodivergent people. I have clinical experience, but I also have lived experience. And I'm researching as well, not in ARFID, but in autism. My practice is informed, and even today, even just when I talk about stuff, it's informed by my clinical practice, my understanding of research, and my lived experience. I try to make it clear as much as I can. I've trained myself to make sure I'm really clear what's my personal experience that I've lived, or maybe like the experience that I see in my friends or my family versus what I see as a clinician in like my clients and what I know from research.
Okay, onwards with the topic. I was wondering to start off, where would you draw the line or not between ARFID, sensory issues, and then a classic eating disorder like anorexia? Is there overlap, or are we trying too hard to separate things that are often entangled and we don't know where to start and where to stop?
Great question. Yes, there can be overlap. Sometimes there's not, but sometimes there is. And maybe important context is when we diagnose ARFID, the diagnostic criteria literally says that there's no body image concerns. And so if we're getting very technical and following the criteria, it would make it very difficult to diagnose both a classic eating disorder like anorexia or bulimia alongside ARFID. And that is frustrating because in my clinical experience, I see it co-occur a lot. Or maybe a lot is a bit extreme, but it definitely can co-occur. And so how that might look is a child, or particularly teenagers, I would say, might have ARFID. And then as a result of that, they aren't gaining much weight, or perhaps they're even losing weight. This is just one example of how one trajectory could take many forms. But in this example, they then receive positive feedback socially for being at what society would consider an ideal weight. And that makes them feel really good because they've had social challenges for most of their childhood. And now people actually talk to them or want to be their friend or think that they look cute. And so that can then escalate into more of a body-focused type of eating difficulty or anorexia or bulimia, where they then try to maintain being that weight, and then it's not really ARFID then, but perhaps it did start that way with eating challenges.
Okay, so it's difficult to know where to start and to stop. So Marie, in terms of your own experience, do you have lived experience yourself around that? Is that why you're obviously interested in identity particularly?
Yeah, a lot of the experiences that are autistic ADHD I'm interested in because of lived experience. And it's so awesome to have an understanding. I spoke last time on with you about how I had worked out I was autistic as a teenager, but had no idea about ADHD. But even having an idea that I was probably autistic, I didn't know much about autism, certainly not to the depths that I do now. And so there's so much missing information that I had about my own experience. And I've been meaning to make an Instagram post about this, but there's a concept, if people want to Google it, hermeneutical injustice. And a very modern philosopher who talks about it a lot is Miranda Fricker. And this concept is that information is kept from people. It doesn't necessarily have to be deliberately, but just because the majority don't have the experience. And so then that minority group don't have access to a framework and language and concepts that impact them. And so a great example of this in feminism was women not being educated and not being allowed to vote. And then they didn't have an understanding of like reproduction, would end up having lots and lots of babies that then put lots of emotional labor on them. And yeah, so there's just, this is how oppression continues. And so if we're thinking about that in terms of autistic ADHD is, if we don't have access to knowledge about how our brain works and what our needs are, and there's no language for that, we try to explain things that are happening to us. This thing happens in my body, or this thing happens in my brain. And people look at us like we're crazy. And that's when the gaslighting happened. If we had a word for that, like I'm having a meltdown and here's what happens in the brain when you have a meltdown, that gives a lot more credibility to what we have to say. And people are more likely to believe us then. So I think that's an important concept when we're talking about all of this stuff. That concept of hermeneutical injustice is because I experienced things as a teenager that I was trying to explain to psychologists and psychiatrists about why I was having trouble eating. And I would say, I just physically can't do it. Like, I feel hungry, I want to eat, and then as soon as I'm like chewing on it, I'm just like, I can't, I need to get it out of my mouth. Like, it can't be in there, or I can't swallow it properly, or whatever it is. Oh, I feel nauseous all the time. And I had health professionals not listen to me about that. And I would say something I hear from heaps of kids, I said the same thing, which is I struggle to eat in front of people. It really stresses me out. In restaurants, forget it. Like the best chance I had of eating was at home alone in my bedroom. Even then it got to a point where that was challenging, but that was the best chance I had to try and get food down. And I was lucky that my parents were very accommodating with that. Otherwise, it would have got worse a lot sooner. So yeah, just not being believed about your self-report was a problem for me. And it's what led to me getting so much worse than I should have. Because what happened was the psychiatrist that I saw, who was supposed to be a specialist in eating disorders, was convinced that I had anorexia and that it was body image driven. And that I was lying and secretly like counting calories and exercising. And I was like, I hate exercise. I don't want to do exercise. And now I know I have a condition called POTS, which has like cardio intolerance. Like I couldn't, that's why I've hated it my whole life. It feels terrible whenever I do any kind of like cardio. And I just wasn't believed. And I was put into treatment in an inpatient facility with adults as a 16-year-old and treated for anorexia, which I didn't have. So of course the treatment didn't work, and the stress of being outside of my home and in an unfamiliar environment around people I didn't know made it worse. And then they prescribed me an antipsychotic because it makes you hungry, and that made me feel really out of it, spacey, not myself. It pretty much made me non-speaking. I really struggled to communicate. And I was just very overwhelmed, and it was a horrible experience. So I ended up in a medical hospital, like just a general hospital pediatric ward for refeeding through an NG tube for several weeks because it got that bad. And this was in the summer holidays between year 11 and year 12. And then I experienced medical trauma. So just as a bit of a like content warning, I'll just describe a little bit very quickly. When you are fed with an NG tube, it's through your nose and down into your stomach through that back way. That wasn't explained to me. That's what was going to happen, how it would be inserted, the fact that it would be very painful. There's no kind of like sedation or anything they can give you for that. I understand that's maybe dangerous now. I didn't know that at the time.
They did that with you.
I was 16. Yeah.
And they didn't even explain it properly.
They just said, this is going to go in and it will feed you and it'll make you better. And I was like, cool. But I remember feeling really stressed about like, how is that? Is it going to go through my mouth or like puncture my stomach? Like they didn't explain anything, but they had mentioned later when I told my parents, and my parents raised the concern that I was held down they were told that's pretty standard just because of how painful it is. A lot of people try to bite it off. And I was like, well, I'm a 16-year-old. You haven't told me. At the time, I didn't think that. I was like, they're doing what they need to do. But now, as an adult who advocates a lot in this space, I'm like, that was not even remotely trauma-informed care. And it did cause a lot of medical trauma for me that I still have today. And like, even just having people in my face, and I have a great dentist who knows about this, and I tap his arm and he just backs off when I start to feel like I'm getting really distressed about having someone in my face and feeling like I can't escape. And he's great. He'll just like back off, give me a few minutes to regulate, and then we try again. So yeah, that was my experience. But I must say, for any kind of parents listening who are like terrified about that option for their children, if that had have been done in a way that was trauma informed, where I had a lot of agency in that process and I understood what was going to happen, I think it probably wouldn't have been traumatic. It would have been like a distressing experience, but probably not one that resulted in PTSD. But it did actually help me recover. So having the control taken away, so someone else is feeding through a tube, it's very like structured. It's the same times every day. You get to know what it feels like. So it's very predictable. And I didn't have to deal with the sensory, like didn't have to chew, didn't have to smell. Like it just goes straight in your stomach. And then you start to feel a lot better because your body's actually getting nutrients that it's been desperately needing. So for me, that did help break the restriction cycle. And I'm happy to talk about what the restriction cycle is, because it usually keeps ARFID going, but we can get to that in the more clinical section.
I would love if you wouldn't mind.
So the general rule is that restriction leads to further restriction, which, so once we start restricting our diet, it usually then just keeps getting smaller and smaller over time. How long that takes differs for everyone, but generally that's the pattern it follows. And people often want to know why that is. So as a bit of a like general rule, this might not apply to everybody. It's because if we're restricting, I guess to a degree where you're not getting enough nutrients or broad range of foods, because you can, there are people with restricted diet who do have a very narrow range of foods that they eat, but it's enough and they're doing okay and it doesn't get any worse. But when you're not getting enough nutrients, your body isn't feeling great because it's not getting what it needs. And so your nervous system is more sensitive because it's just not getting its basic needs met. So you're more hyper aroused, or your sensory stuff gets worse. Your appetite is lower. All those things that happen when our bodies are under stress, which then makes it even harder to eat if you don't have an appetite or you feel really nauseous. And so then the foods that we can tolerate, so maybe even some of the safe foods then are like, oh, I can't do the texture of that today. And so then we lose that safe food, and then it progresses like that. And then you get more malnourished. So then more stressed and more sensitive. And so it goes in a bit of a vicious cycle like that. To link that back to my lived experience, for me, having the NG tube feeding broke that cycle because I was getting enough nutrients so that after a few weeks, I felt much better in my body and more able to tolerate introducing new food, like very slowly at my own pace. And I actually, at that point, was assigned a dietitian in the hospital. And I would say, looking back, whether she knew it or not, she was very trauma informed.
That's great.
Yeah. And said to me, like, what foods do you think you could start with? I need them to be high calorie, Marie. So like Tim Tams. And I was like, I love Tim Tams. Yes. A Savoy cracker and a mint slice were the first foods I remember trying after, like, at that point, it would have been 4 months without any food in my mouth.
Wow. Okay. So you come out of hospital. Obviously, the tube going in was really traumatic. However, in some ways, it did help you. And then you went home, you'd seen the dietitian. Did you then improve slowly, or did it go back and forth? What happened then?
I think initially I improved slowly and it just kept improving. And that was done in a really structured way. Like, I saw that dietitian every 2 weeks for, I think it was like a year, as an outpatient in the hospital. And I had meal plans which as an autistic person, looking back, I'm like, oh, that's why that helped. I had a really structured, like, at this time you eat this, at this time you eat this. And there were things that I felt safe, and we never made changes to that meal plan without a meeting and without me like saying, I feel safe to try that. Do you like it? Yep. Okay. Let's add it to your meal plan. I wouldn't necessarily recommend that for everyone. I was happy to do it because it was predictable and because I had enough options at that point. So I can't do a cheese sandwich today, but I can do butter pasta. And so for me, it worked. But what really helped me get to where I am now, where I'm actually happy to try new foods and things when I go out, was moving from that really structured approach to intuitive eating, which is like just listening to your body. When is it hungry? When is it not hungry? And your hunger cues are so out of whack if you haven't been eating enough for any length of time. So it's not necessarily something you can do straight away with someone with ARFID if their hunger signals are all out of whack. Mine were gone at that point. I didn't even feel hunger at all, really. But having that structured start with the meal plan at the usual times helped me develop, like, your body knows it's getting lunch at one every day. So then around 12:45, I would start to feel hungry because of that circadian rhythm or body clock. And then once I understood those, all those cues were back and I could recognize them, then I could start doing more of that intuitive eating.
Right. Okay. Burning question for you, Marie. So we've done a couple of episodes on ARFID. So we've had Claire Bruton on, we've had Margot White. I can put them in the show notes for anybody who's not listened. So we've done some basics. But I was just wondering, there's so many mums on this podcast who have got children with ARFID. And a lot of the messages around, you don't want to put too much pressure on and creating a lot of anxiety and make it.
Oh, my gosh.
Right. So we've explored that. So I was just wondering, though, from your perspective as someone who's really lived that, when do you move from just grab it when you need, taking the pressure off, letting them choose, taking them to the supermarket, to like NG tube, we've really got to jump in and get help and this is a big deal and we need to make it, need to do something.
Where is that? That's so hard because it's not really a line you can tell sometimes by observing. So in instances where it really is clear, they're feeling really dizzy frequently, or I had started to grow those little fine hairs all over my body, lanugo, because I was like significantly underweight. My fingers and toes didn't have proper circulation and they were blue often. Those are like immediately get medical attention. But sometimes I wouldn't say, like, I wouldn't wait for it to get there, because sometimes there can be medical concerns that don't have any signs or symptoms outwardly that you wouldn't know unless you did a blood test. So usually what I recommend with ARFID, and even today, I still go through periods where I struggle a bit with food, and I now understand that's related to stress and also related to some of my health conditions. So another one, in case I forget it for today, biggest recommendation is thorough medical investigation for anyone who has eating difficulties, because I think it gets explained away as anxiety or autism, or it's just sensory stuff, or it's just anxiety. But so many of my clients with ARFID have an underlying health condition that exacerbates it or potentially even caused it. And once you get treatment for whatever that is, whether it's celiac or mast cell activation or so many things.
Okay. For pediatricians, are incredibly hard to get into. They're incredibly expensive. If you had a child with ARFID, can you go to a good GP and say, what would be an example of some things we're looking for?
So you would go for monitoring. So you go to a GP, and I say even for adults, that's where I was. Even for adults, even for me, who's been on top of it for all of adulthood, I still get a blood test every 6 months to make sure that everything is okay, all my levels and everything. So yeah, if we've got a kid really struggling, then I don't know what the time frame would be. You'd have to ask the doctor, but just a regular kind of check-in, check-up. If they're going to weigh them, I would be like, do we have to? And if we have to, can we not make it a big deal? Maybe not have them see the number. Like, we don't want to start feeding into what could potentially spiral into a more traditional eating disorder. So yes, a GP, if they feel comfortable working with kids, can monitor for any, like, where is the line with needing more escalated medical intervention.
Interesting. You know, a doctor told me the other day, and I just blew my mind. I went out for dinner, and of course I started talking about autism and Arthur because that's who I am. And he was an amazing GP, and he treats a lot of neurodivergent kids. And he said, very similar to what you were saying, that he does the testing. But then I said to him, oh, my kids, it's so difficult to get them to take a tablet. And he goes, but we compound it all. We figure out where they at. And then we just have one tablet that they take in the morning. They've only got to take one. And that has all of the nutrients, all of whatever it is that they need that they're lacking, just goes in one tablet. And I was like, mind blown. I was so excited because I said to him, I just feel like there's no point taking a child, well, my children anyway, to a naturopath. They're not going to take 16 tablets and powders.
Exactly.
Like, he goes, oh, we just compound that. And I was like, wow.
Yeah. Wow. I didn't know that. That's great. I think dietitians are seriously overlooked in this space. When I work with kids like this, they've often been to a speech pathologist to look at if there's any oral motor stuff going on, or they're with a pediatrician, or there's a psychologist to do therapy. And a lot of them either haven't seen a dietitian, or they saw one who doesn't sound like knew much about autism and stuff. Here's all the things they need. And if they eat that, they're fine. But seriously, if you find a dietitian that is trauma-informed, neuroaffirming, they have so much knowledge. Like, this is their area of expertise, right? And they can read the blood tests and know even the limitations of some of the tests. I've had dietitians say, yeah, sure, that B12 is in the normal range, but it's on the lower end and those tests aren't very sensitive sometimes, so it could actually be pretty low. We need to do it again or do a more sophisticated type of B12 test. So they're like super knowledgeable. I've learned so much from working alongside dietitians. So that would be a recommendation I usually give people. And I do know some dietitians in this space. I have a list on my website because I think it's so important.
That's a really great point that you've made. I feel like dietitians and OTs, if you see one and it doesn't go great, sometimes I feel like people go, oh, well, they didn't know anything. What would be, you said trauma-informed neuroaffirming. If there was a mum on here that was trying to find somebody, what would be some things you'd look for on the website?
If somebody says they have experience working with neurodivergent people, that's great. The other thing, like, unfortunately, we're now at a time where the meaning of neuroaffirming has been diluted a bit because lots of services know that's a good marketing tool, even if they're not in their practice embodying those principles of being neuroaffirming. So you could look for that. Other green flags I've noticed with dietitians is if they talk about intuitive eating. So that's probably going to be a dietitian who's not going to be really rigid and black and white about food. Sometimes that can really feed how rules-based we can be as autistic people, and it can get a bit out of hand. So that more flexible approach of helping people understand hunger cues and eat when you need, stop when you feel like you're done. What do cravings mean? What is your body telling you maybe what nutrients it needs and things like that? And then the other thing I look for on websites is health at every size or anti-diet, because they essentially mean they're going to place less emphasis on weight, weight gain, weight loss, and focus more on health. So how you want to feel or achieve the goals. If you say you want to be able to go for a 20-minute walk without feeling like you're dying, how do we get you to that? It's got nothing to do with your weight or BMI.
I think that you've made a great point. So in terms of these challenges affecting someone's identity, for so many of us, food struggles start really young. Then they get tangled up in shame, control, our sense of self. How does it all work in together, do you think?
Firstly, food is deeply tied to family and culture, comfort, autonomy. So lots of things that are part of our identity. And if you've always struggled with eating, especially as a child, I think that struggle can become part of how you see yourself. Like, I'm a picky eater, or you know, the way I eat is embarrassing, which then impacts, do you want to eat in front of other people? Like, for me, eating in front of other people when I was younger was so stressful. We've been saying this whole time, everyone is so different. Obviously, a lot of people do struggle from when they're little, or a really common age I see around 2, 3, they just drop off heaps of foods. I actually ate so well until puberty. And then I think it was just everything, just school hormones. And that's when my sensory stuff got even worse and I started to restrict. So for me, that was really like where it kicked off. But it can happen much younger when, yeah, we're really forming who we are and how we see ourselves. You can see even parents, if they don't express their concern, you can feel the anxiety as a child. If you're really tuned into that stuff, some kids aren't, but I was highly like sensitive to tension. And I always have been, like, my mum calls me a sponge. So I could feel the fear in the room from like my family. And in public, it was like, there are parts of the food I want to be able to pick out, or I don't want to eat the crust of my pizza. And I don't know how to deal with waiters or coming up to me and being like, eat your crust and you'll grow nice and strong, or whatever those comments are that people give you when you leave things on your plate. And I was like, I just can't deal with that. It's very stressful. It's a lot of attention that I don't want on me. So yeah, all of this stuff I think is tied in. And then you start to get embarrassed about eating in front of people. You're like, it's better to just avoid it. Don't want to hang out with my friends if they're going to get a meal, because then I'm going to have to eat in front of them. Because if you don't eat, it's weird. Or people start thinking you have anorexia if you're not eating all the time. So it gets very overwhelming. And of course, then we can develop beliefs about ourselves, like I'm difficult or there's something wrong with me.
That's really interesting, because then you're restricting your social circle in some circumstances. I've seen mums that find it really difficult because if they have a child over for a play date, let's say, then the other mum very kindly says, I'll have your child over for a play date. But that mum doesn't know what on earth their child would eat at someone else's house. So then you'd say, okay, I'll send this safe food. Well, you wouldn't necessarily say safe food, but here's your lunch you take with you. And the other parent's like, oh, no, I'll feed them. It's totally fine. Mm-hmm. And you don't want to make it a big deal or embarrass your child, but you're also thinking to yourself, if the mum or the dad says, come and have this chicken roll, everyone loves them, they're so good, you know your child's not going to eat that.
Yeah.
And it can be really restrictive.
Absolutely. And I think the culture around food is so ingrained. It's probably the one that I see the most that's the hardest to unpack, and the norms around food and eating. I've worked with parents who are just phenomenal, have done all their own understanding and reading and research of neuroaffirming, are absolutely nailing that in their parenting. And then once we start to tackle eating and feeding, I'm like, oh, hang on. They're coming out with these beliefs. Like, literally, we'll say meal times, we need them at the table because we're a family and that we need to do that. Or they need to be seated, or there's no screens at the table. And I'm like, where are all these rules coming from? Because you don't do that in your parenting anywhere else. And it's almost like that final frontier of that's the one that's so permanent in there that we haven't stopped to evaluate that one because it's so ingrained.
Yeah. And I've read a piece of research around the outcomes for family that eat around the table. And the research says that you have a happier, more harmonious home or whatever it is if you eat at the table without screen, then you will talk about your day. And when I went ahead and attempted to do that, because I wanted to be the best mum I can be, it's a good intention, I saw the food challenges that I had escalate very, very, very quickly. So that rigidity did not work. And what I found was, particularly one of my children who struggles to put on weight, I have to really give him something else to look at and concentrate on, and privacy for him to actually get anything into his body. And it's been a real tricky thing with my husband and I, because that has really come up against some of our beliefs. But at the end of the day, we've actually see that not work in our family. So we've had to drop it.
Absolutely. I tell my mum often, but a lot of stuff she doesn't nail. Like, she's not great at a lot of stuff, but phenomenal at other things. And so I remind her all the time, we are an Italian family. My family immigrated in the 60s from Italy, from a very poor peasant town. I don't eat meat, but they do. And they could only afford to eat meat twice a year, Easter and Christmas. Like, that's how poor. And so the idea of wasting food is just, you don't go there. That is so offensive. So that was a hard thing for me growing up, that I had to try and navigate that whole thing and food being so central to the family. But then thinking as well about my mom coming from that context and that background where food and family, arguably the two most important things to Italian people, she saw that I was eating more if I was in my room. And so it was like, go for it. I didn't have to fight her on it. It wasn't difficult at all. And so I remind her all the time that made a huge, huge difference for me as a kid. And it really went against the culture that is so entrenched for us as an Italian family.
I think that's so great. My husband, he came from a background where they didn't have a surplus of food. And so food was very much like everyone ate everything and scraped it because there wasn't enough for the amount of people that were there. And so for him, he's found it incredibly aggravating when we have children that won't eat something that we've made, we're throwing it out. And I love your perspective because that's one of the reasons we got chickens, was because it's like a bit of a scaffold for me. I'm like, well, the chickens, they really enjoy that. Let's take it out to the chickens, because scraping it into a bin can add a lot of pressure or negative energy, even if you're not trying to.
Yeah. And especially with the cost of living, this is such a barrier, right? People are struggling financially at the moment, and to suggest having a range of foods available for your, in an ideal world, right? If money weren't a problem, we would have so much food there, and the child just goes and gets whatever they feel like. And that's intuitive eating. And then they learn from natural consequence. Not all children, I see some absolutely raging ADHDers who just never learn. Like, they get so sick from eating so much chocolate, and then they'll do it again the very next day. But you can see, you can work out fairly quickly if that's your child or if your child's going to learn from natural. I learned from natural consequence. I hate feeling bad in my body. I'm very sensitive with my interoception. As soon as I got any kind of tummy ache or whatever, I was like, oh, no, don't want that to happen again. So that's my limit. And yeah, so I did learn from just having access. I never had any food restricted by my parents. I was allowed to eat whatever I wanted, whenever I wanted. And you eat an entire pack of Tim Tams after school, feel sick, don't do it again. Well, that was for me anyway, but not every kid is like that. So that's why it's so individual.
Okay, so one of the last questions, Marie, what does a neuroaffirming path to recovery or support actually look like? We're not talking about food diaries, obviously. What would be a better framework that parents who are listening could look at for their children or for themselves?
Speaking of unpacking our own emotional responses to things and the rules we've learned, which, by the way, one of the most important things to be doing for parents who have kids with these eating challenges, reflecting on like how you were parented, what beliefs and attitudes you have around food and why. It's important. Like you were saying, you want the family, you want time together, quality time. Okay, why does that have to be around food? Can we set up like a movie night twice a week or some other activity that doesn't center around food to get that bonding? Because really, I wouldn't be surprised if that's what that research was actually measuring. Is it actually the meal or is it just the quality time?
I would agree with that.
And when you've got a neurodivergent family, mealtime, more often than not, is not quality time. It is the most stressful time of the day. I'm trying to meet everyone's different needs around food, around sensory, it's just really stressful. So yeah, finding another way about it. If we're thinking about recovery, I think really reflecting on what are our goals that are not food related. Like, we want our child to be happy. We want them to be physically well. And we want quality time as a family. Those are perfectly reasonable goals and values to have. And they're achievable outside of the way people are going about it. Is we think the way to achieve those things is to have my child sit at the table, have them be able to eat a range of foods, think outside the box. Like, that doesn't necessarily get you the outcome you're wanting and can get you further away from the outcome you're wanting sometimes. So I think recovery doesn't have to mean full flexibility around food. Some people do get there. I think I still find it hard to eat at a lot of places, but I know how to work with my needs now. So I think focusing on that, focusing on being curious. So why is that food hard? Why that specific food? Or why this specific environment? And if we get curious and we figure out what someone's needs are, we can then meet those needs better. And then we can start fitting that into or making it work with the goals that we have or they have for themselves. So I want more quality time with my family. Okay, great. So you need a quiet space and something else to keep your brain stimulated while you eat. So maybe mealtime isn't the time we try and get quality family time.
Okay, so for closing, for any mum who's listening who's navigating food stress for their kids or for themselves, is there a mantra they can hold on to this week? It can be really tough in this space. I talk openly that it's probably my most difficult parenting area.
Yes, I've got a few. So I guess mostly for parents and health professionals, the little mantra that I would have is curiosity over control always. So we want to be curious. We don't want to control our children.
That could go across general parenting, hey?
Yeah. So always curious. Why? I want to understand why. And even as a clinician, sometimes I get really excited because I feel like something clicked in my head when I'm working with a kid and I'm like, oh my God, I've got like a theory or a hypothesis for why this has been such a problem. And I want to be like, oh, this is because XYZ. And then I'm like, no, no. That's me being the expert and lecturing them. I'm going to stop and I'm going to be like, hey, I've observed something and I want to get your feedback on it. Here's what I've noticed. And then I share it and I'm like, what do you think? And then that is a much more constructive conversation then. But I acknowledge I don't have all the information that you've got available in your mind. So I'm going to present it to you and you tell me, can we put our information together and do they fit or am I missing information? Or, and I find that goes a lot better. And so, yeah, it's more constructive. It fosters trust. Trust is so important in this space. If your kids ever find out you're hiding food or medication, good luck coming back from that one. I've seen that rupture relationships very easily. So collaborative as much as we can be. And yeah, sometimes I have kids give consent to hide things in their food, which I find so interesting. So I've tried that recently with a few kids. I'm just like, hey, if it's in there and you don't know and it tastes fine, are you cool with that? Should we tell your parents to start trying that? And they're like, yeah, that would be amazing. So then I don't have to think about it. And I'm like, all right, cool. But if at any point you're like, nah, it's making me too anxious not knowing if there's something in this food, we can say, all right, we're not going to do that anymore. So yeah, that really collaborative, giving them lots of agency. So curiosity over control always. Then I think for just more in general with ARFID, it's okay for progress to look like eating enough, not eating everything. So you don't have to do food perfectly to do it well enough. Sometimes grief comes with that for parents because they did envision having a child that they could go to restaurants with, or so you have to deal with that. But I guess that doesn't mean they're going to be miserable as adults. And I can say that as an adult whose adult friends, every single one of my friends is autistic, diagnosed. I say that in case there are parents who give more weight to a formal diagnosis and we find a way to have such joyful experiences together that don't revolve around food. Or if they do, we accommodate one another. So it's actually fine to bring your own food when we hang out. Or people do different like Uber orders in the same room. There are ways to just accommodate this stuff and still have a really like rich, meaningful social lives.
That's really beautiful.
Yeah, I'm glad. And you're allowed to nourish yourself in ways that make sense to you. And lastly, this is probably my favorite one. I've already got goosebumps. Your body is not the problem. The problem is the world that taught you to not trust your body.
Wow.
Okay.
That last one, hey, it's beautiful. Yeah. So if you'd like to hear more about Marie and her work, I'm going to add in her Instagram and her social media on the show notes. I'm also going to add in her website. I'm sure that there'll be people that will be wanting to have a look up Marie again. I'd love to get you back, Marie, as well. And thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Jane. Always a pleasure.
Quick announcement. Did you know that we have an ADHD month shop filled with resources designed just for you? These resources are packed with answers to the most frequently asked questions I get sent in via email. Everything from understanding ADHD and autism to practical tips for daily life. There's also a free assessment tool.
If you're wondering about ADHD or autism for yourself or your little one, don't forget to check out the free assessment tool under free resources section on my website, adhdmums.com.au.